loyal friends, you know your customers and employees will be there for you when you need them most. It's the feeling of we're in this together, shared between the customer and the company, voter and candidate, boss and employee, that defines great leaders. In contrast, relying on manipulations creates massive stress for buyer and for seller alike. For the buyer, it has become increasingly difficult to know which product or service, brand or company is best. I joke about the proliferation of toothpaste varieties and the difficulty of choosing the right one, but toothpaste is just a metaphor. Nearly every decision we're asked to make every day is like choosing toothpaste. Deciding what law firm to hire, which college to attend, which car to buy, which company to work for, which candidate to elect. There are too many choices. All the advertising and promotions and pressure employ to tempt us one way or the other, each trying to push us harder than the other, to court us for our money or our support or our vote, ultimately yields to one consistent result. Stress. For the companies too, whose obligation it is to help us decide, their ability to do so effectively has gotten so difficult. Every day, the competition is doing something new, something better. To constantly have to come up with a new promotion, a new guerrilla marketing tactic, a new feature to add is hard work. Combined with the long-term effects of years and years of short-term decisions that have eroded profit margins, this raises stress levels inside organizations as well. When manipulations are the norm, no one wins. It's not an accident that doing business today and being in the workforce today is more stressful than it used to be. Peter Wybrow, in his book American Mania, When More Is Not Enough, argues that many of the ills that we suffer from today have very little to do with the bad food we're eating or the partially hydrogenated oils in our diet. Rather, Wybrow says, it's the way that corporate America has developed that has increased our stress to levels so high we're literally making ourselves sick because of it. Americans are suffering ulcers, depression, high blood pressure, anxiety, and cancer at record levels. According to Wybrow, all those promises of more, more, more are actually overloading the reward circuits of our brain. The short-term gains that drive business in America today are actually destroying our health. Just because it works doesn't make it right. The danger of manipulations is that they work. And because manipulations work, they've become the norm, practiced by the vast majority of companies and organizations, regardless of size or industry. That fact alone creates a systemic peer pressure. With perfect irony, we, the manipulators, have been manipulated by our own system. With every price drop, promotion, fear-based or aspirational message and novelty we use to achieve our goals, we find our companies, our organizations, and our systems getting weaker and weaker. The economic crisis that began in 2008 is just another, albeit extreme, example of what can happen if a flawed assumption is allowed to carry on for too long. The collapse of the housing market and the subsequent collapse of the banking industry were due to the decisions made inside the banks based on a series of manipulations. Employees were manipulated with bonuses that encouraged short-sighted decision-making. Open shaming of anyone who spoke out disparaged responsible dissent. A free flow of loans encouraged aspiring homebuyers to buy more than they could afford at all price levels. There was very little loyalty. It was all a series of transactional decisions, effective, but at a very high cost. Few were working for the good of the whole. Why would they? There was no reason given to do so. There was no cause or belief beyond the instant gratification. Bankers weren't the first ones to be swept up by their own success. American car manufacturers have conducted themselves the same way for decades, manipulation after manipulation. Short-term decision built upon short-term decision. Buckling, or even collapse, is the only logical conclusion when manipulations are the main course of action. The reality is, in today's world, manipulations are the norm. But there is an alternative. Part 2. An Alternative Perspective. Chapter 3. The Golden Circle. There are a few leaders who choose to inspire rather than manipulate in order to motivate people. Whether individuals or organizations, Every single one of these inspiring leaders thinks, acts, and communicates the exact same way, and it's the complete opposite to the rest of us. Consciously or not, how they do it is by following a naturally occurring pattern that I call the golden circle. The concept of the golden circle was inspired by the golden ratio, a simple mathematical relationship that has fascinated mathematicians, biologists, architects, artists, musicians, and naturists since the beginning of history, from the Egyptians to Pythagoras to Leonardo da Vinci. Many have looked to the golden ratio to provide a mathematical formula for proportion or even beauty. It also supports the notion that there is more order in nature than we like to think, as in the symmetry of leaves and the geometric perfection of snowflakes. What I found so attractive about the golden ratio, however, was that it had so many applications in so many fields. And even more significantly, it offered a formula that could produce repeatable and predictable results in places where such results might have been assumed to be random occurrences or just luck. Even Mother Nature, for most people a symbol of unpredictability, exhibited more order than we previously acknowledged. Like the golden ratio, which offers evidence of order in the seeming disorder of nature, the golden circle finds order and predictability in human behavior. Put simply, it helps us understand why we do what we do. The golden circle provides compelling evidence of how much more we can achieve if we remind ourselves to start everything we do by first asking why. The golden circle is an alternative perspective to existing assumptions about why some leaders and organizations have achieved such a disproportionate degree of influence. It offers clear insight as to how Apple is able to innovate in so many diverse industries and never lose its ability to do so. It explains why people tattoo Harley-Davidson logos on their body. It provides a clear understanding, not just for how Southwest Airlines created the most profitable airline in history, but why the things they did worked. It even gives some clarity as to why people followed Dr. Martin Luther King in a movement that changed a nation, and why we took up John F. Kennedy's challenge to put a man on the moon even after he died. The Golden Circle shows us how these leaders were able to inspire action instead of manipulating people to act. This alternative perspective is not just useful for changing the world. There are practical applications for the ability to inspire too. It can be used as a guide to vastly improving leadership, corporate culture, hiring, product development, sales, and marketing. It even explains loyalty and how to create enough momentum to turn an idea into a social movement. And it all starts from the inside out. It all starts with why. Before we can explore its applications, let me first define the terms. Imagine a bullseye. In the center is the word why. In the middle ring is the word how. And in the outside ring is the word what. But before we can explore its applications, let me first define the terms, starting from the outside of the circle and moving inward. What? Every single company and organization on the planet knows what they do. This is true no matter how big or small, no matter what industry. Everyone is easily able to describe the products or services a company sells or the job function they have within that system. Whats are easy to identify. How? Some companies and people know how they do what they do. Whether you call them a differentiating value proposition, proprietary process, or unique selling proposition, hows are often given to explain how something is different or better. Not as obvious as what's, many think that it is these things that are the differentiating or motivating factors in a decision. It would be false to assume that's all that is required, however. There's one missing detail. Why? Very few people or companies can clearly articulate why they do what they do. When I say why, I don't mean to make money. That's a result. By why, I mean what's your purpose, what's your cause, what's your belief? Why does your company exist? Why did you get out of bed this morning? And why should anyone care? When most organizations or people think, act, or communicate, they do so from the outside in of the golden circle, from what to why. And for good reason, they go from the clearest thing to the fuzziest thing. We say what we do. We sometimes say how we do it or how we're better. But we rarely say why we do what we do. But not the inspiring companies and not the inspiring leaders. Every single one of them, regardless of their size, regardless of their industry, thinks, acts, and communicates from the inside out. I use Apple frequently as an example, simply because they have broad recognition and their products are easy to grasp and to compare to others. In other words, we all get it. What's more, Apple's success over time is not typical. Their ability to remain one of the most innovative companies year after year, combined with their uncanny ability to attract a cult-like following, makes them a great example to demonstrate many of the principles of the Golden Circle. I'll start with a simple marketing example. If Apple were like other companies, a marketing message from them would move from the outside in of the Golden Circle. It would start with some statement of what the company does or makes, followed by how they think they are different or better than their competition, followed by some call to action. With that, the company would expect some sort of behavior in return, in this case, a purchase. A marketing message from Apple, if they were like everyone else, might sound like this. We make great computers. They're beautifully designed, simple to use, and user-friendly. Want to buy one? It's not a very compelling sales pitch, but that's how most companies sell to us. This is the norm. First, they start with what they do. Here's our new car, for example. Then they tell us how they do it better or how they think it's better. It's got leather seats, great gas mileage, and great financing. And then they make a call to action and expect a behavior. You see this pattern in business-to-consumer markets as well as business-to-business environments. Here's our new law firm. Our lawyers went to the best schools and we represent the biggest clients. Hire us. This pattern is also alive and well in politics. Here's the candidate. Here are her views on taxes and immigration. See how she's different? Vote for her. In every case, the communication is organized in an attempt to convince someone of a difference or superior value. But that is not what the inspiring leaders and inspiring organizations do. Every one of them, regardless of size or industry, thinks, acts, and communicates from the inside out. Let's look at that Apple example again and rewrite the example in the order Apple actually communicates. This time, the example starts with why. Everything we do, we believe in challenging the status quo. We believe in thinking differently. The way we challenge the status quo is by making our products beautifully designed, simple to use, and user-friendly. We just happen to make great computers. Want to buy one? It's a completely different message. It actually feels different from the first one I read. You're actually more eager to buy a computer from Apple after I read the second version. And all I did was reverse the order of the information. There's no trickery, no manipulation, no free stuff, no aspirational messages, no celebrities. Apple doesn't simply reverse the order of the information. Their message starts with why, a purpose, cause, or belief that has nothing to do with what they do. What they do, the products they make, from computers to small electronics, no longer serve as the reason to buy. They serve as the tangible proof of their cause. The design and the user interface of Apple products, though important, are not enough in themselves to generate such astounding loyalty among their customers. Those important elements make the cause tangible and rational. Others can hire top designers and brilliant engineers and make beautiful, easy-to-use products and even copy all the things that Apple does. They can even steal away Apple employees to do it. But the results would not be the same. Simply copying what Apple does or how it does it won't work. There is something more, something hard to describe and near impossible to copy that gives Apple such a disproportionate level of influence in their market. The example stands to prove that people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. That's worth repeating. People don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. Apple's ability to design such innovative products so consistently and their ability to command such astounding loyalty for their products comes from more than simply what they do. The problem is, organizations use the tangible features and benefits to build a rational argument for why their company, product, or idea is better than another. Sometimes those comparisons are made outright, and sometimes analogies or metaphors are drawn, but the effect is the same. Companies try to sell us what they do, but we buy why they do it. This is what I mean when I say they communicate from the outside in. They lead with what and how. When communicating from the inside out, however, the why is offered as the reason to buy, and whats serve as the tangible proof of what they believe. The things we can point to rationalize or explain the reasons we're drawn to one product, company, or idea over another. What companies do are external factors, but why they do it is something deeper. It's something internal. In practical terms, there is nothing special about Apple. It is just a company like any other. There is no real difference between Apple and any of its competitors, Dell, HP, Gateway, Toshiba. Pick one, it doesn't matter. They are all corporate structures. That's all a company is. It's a structure. They all make computers. They all have some systems that work and some that don't. They all have equal access to the same talent, the same resources, the same agencies, and the same consultants, and the same media. They all have some good managers, some good designers, and some smart engineers. They all make some products that work well and some that don't, even Apple. Why, then, does Apple have such a disproportionate level of success? Why are they more innovative? Why are they consistently more profitable? And how did they manage to build such a cultish, loyal following, something very few companies are ever able to achieve? People don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. This is the reason Apple has earned a remarkable level of flexibility. People are obviously comfortable buying a computer from Apple, but people are also perfectly comfortable buying an MP3 player from them, or a cell phone, or a DVR. Consumers and investors are completely at ease with Apple offering so many different products in so many different categories. It's not what Apple does that distinguishes them. It's why they do it. Their products give life to their cause. I'm not so foolhardy as to propose that their products don't matter. Of course they do. But it's the reason they matter that is contrary to the conventional wisdom. Their products unto themselves are not the reason Apple is perceived as superior. Their products, what Apple makes, serve as the tangible proof of what they believe. It is the clear correlation between what they do and why they do it that makes Apple stand out. This is the reason we perceive Apple as being authentic. Everything they do works to demonstrate their why, to challenge the status quo. Regardless of the products they make or the industry in which they operate, it is always clear that Apple thinks different. When Apple first came out with the Macintosh, having an operating system based on a graphical user interface and not a complicated computer language, this challenged how computers worked at the time. What's more, where most technology companies saw their biggest marketing opportunity among businesses, Apple wanted to give an individual sitting at home the same power as any company. Apple's why, to challenge the status quo and to empower the individual, is a pattern that is repeated in all they say and all they do. It comes to life in their iPod and even more so in iTunes, a service that challenged the status quo of the music industry's distribution model and was better suited to how individuals consumed music in this modern day. The music industry was organized to sell albums, a model that evolved during a time when listening to music was largely an activity we did at home. Sony changed that in 1979 with the introduction of the Walkman. But even the Walkman, and later the Discman, was limited to the number of cassette tapes or CDs you could carry in addition to the device. The development of the MP3 music format changed all that. Digital compression allowed for a very high quantity of songs to be stored on a relatively inexpensive and highly portable digital music device. Our ability to walk out of the house with only one easy-to-carry device transformed music into something we largely listen to away from home. And the MP3 not only changed where we listen to music, it also transformed us from an album-collecting culture to a song-collecting culture. While the music industry was still busy trying to sell us albums, a model that no longer suited consumer behavior, Apple introduced their iPod by offering us 1,000 songs in your pocket. With the iPod and iTunes, Apple did a much better job of communicating the value of both the MP3 and the MP3 player relative to how we lived our actual lives. Their advertising didn't offer exhaustive descriptions of product details. It wasn't about them. It was about us, and we understood why we wanted it. Apple did not invent the MP3, nor did they invent the technology that became the iPod. Yet they are credited with transforming the music industry with it. The multi-gigabyte portable hard drive music player was actually invented by Creative Technology, a Singapore-based technology company that rose to prominence by making the Sound Blaster audio technology that enables your home PC to have sound. In fact, Apple didn't introduce the iPod until 22 months after Creative's entry into the market. This detail alone calls into question the assumption of a first mover's advantage. Given their history in digital sound, Creative was more qualified than Apple to introduce a digital music product. The problem was they advertised their product as a 5 gigabyte MP3 player. It is exactly the same message as Apple's 1,000 songs in your pocket. The difference is Creative told us what their product was and Apple told us why we needed it. Only later, once we decided we had to have an iPod, did the what matter. And we chose the 5 gigabyte version or the 10 gigabyte version and so on. The tangible details that proved we could get the 1,000 songs in our pocket. Our decision started with why, and so did Apple's offering. How many of us can say with certainty that indeed an iPod is actually better than Creative Zen? iPods, for example, are still plagued with battery life and battery replacement issues. They tend to just die. Maybe a Zen is better. The reality is, we don't know and we don't even care if it is. People don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. And it is Apple's clarity of why that gives them such a remarkable ability to innovate, often competing against companies seemingly more qualified than they. And more importantly, they succeed in those industries outside their core business. The same cannot be said for companies with a fuzzy sense of why. When an organization defines itself by what it does, that's all they will ever be able to do. Apple's competitors, having defined themselves by their products or services, regardless of their differentiating value proposition, are not afforded the same freedom as Apple. Gateway, for example, started selling flat-screen TVs in 2003. Having made flat-screen monitors for years, they were every bit as qualified to make and sell TVs. But the company failed to make a credible name for itself among the consumer electronics brands and gave up the business 2 years later to focus on its quote-unquote core business. Dell came out with PDAs in 2002 and MP3 players in 2003, but lasted only a few years in each market. Dell makes good quality products and is fully qualified to produce these and other technologies. The problem was they had defined themselves by what they did. They made computers, and it simply didn't make sense for us to buy a PDA or MP3 player from them. It didn't feel right. How many people do you think would stand in line for 6 hours to buy a new cell phone from Dell, as they did for the release of Apple's iPhone? People couldn't see Dell as anything more than a computer company. It just didn't make sense. Poor sales quickly ended Dell's desire to enter the small electronic goods market, and instead they opted to focus on their core business. Unless Dell, like so many others, can rediscover their founding purpose, cause, or belief, and start with why in all they say and all they do, all they will ever do is sell computers. They will be stuck in their core business. Apple, unlike its competitors, has defined itself by why it does things, not what it does. It is not a computer company, but a company that challenges the status quo and offers individuals simpler alternatives. Apple even changed its legal name in 2007 from Apple Computer Inc. to Apple Inc. to reflect the fact that they were more than just a computer company. Practically speaking, it doesn't really matter what a company's legal name is. For Apple, however, having the word computer in their name didn't limit what they could do. It limited how they thought of themselves. The change wasn't practical. It was philosophical. Apple's why was formed at its founding in the late 1970s and hasn't changed to this date. Regardless of the products they make or the industries into which they migrate, their why still remains a constant. And Apple's intention to challenge accepted thinking has proved prophetic. As a computer company, they redirected the course of the personal computing industry. As a small electronics company, they have challenged the traditional dominance of companies like Sony and Philips. As a purveyor of mobile phones, they push the old hands, Motorola, Ericsson, and Nokia, to re-examine their own businesses. Apple's ability to enter and even dominate so many different industries has even challenged what it means to be a computer company in the first place. Regardless of what it does, We know why Apple exists. The same cannot be said for their competitors. Although they all had a clear sense of why at some point, it was one of the primary factors that helped each of them become billion-dollar companies. Over the course of time, all of Apple's competitors lost their why. Now, all these companies define themselves by what they do. We make computers. They turn from companies with a cause into companies that sold products. And when that happens, price, quality, service, and features become the primary currency to motivate a purchase decision. At that point, a company and its products have ostensibly become commodities. As any company forced to compete on price, quality, service, or features alone can attest, it is very hard to differentiate for any period of time or build loyalty on these factors alone. Plus, it costs money and is stressful to wake up every day trying to compete on that level alone. Knowing why is essential for lasting success and the ability to avoid being lumped in with the others. Any company faced with the challenge of how to differentiate themselves in their market is basically a commodity, regardless of what you do or how you do it. Ask a milk producer, for example, and they will tell you that there are actually variations among milk brands. The problem is, you have to be an expert to understand the differences. To the outside world, all milk is basically the same. So we just lump all the brands together and call it a commodity. In response, that's how the industry acts. This is largely the pattern for almost every other product or service on the market today, business to consumer or business to business. They focus on what they do and how they do it without consideration of why. We lump them together and they act like commodities. The more we treat them like commodities, the more they focus on what and how they do it, and the vicious cycle commences. But only companies that act like commodities are the ones who wake up every day with the challenge of how to differentiate. Companies and organizations with a clear sense of why never worry about it. They don't think of themselves as being like anyone else, and they don't have to convince anyone of their value. They don't need complex systems of carrots and sticks. They are different, and everyone knows it. They start with why in everything they say and everything they do. There are those who still believe that Apple's difference comes from its marketing ability. Apple sells a lifestyle, marketing professionals will tell you. Then how come these marketing professionals haven't intentionally repeated Apple's success and longevity for another company? Calling it a lifestyle is a recognition that people who live a certain way choose to incorporate Apple into their lives. Apple didn't invent the lifestyle, nor does it sell a lifestyle. Apple is simply one of the brands that those who live a certain lifestyle are drawn to. Those people use certain products or certain brands in the course of living in that lifestyle. That is, in part, how we recognize their way of life in the first place. The products they choose become proof of why they do things. It is only because Apple's why is so clear that those who believe what Apple believes are drawn to them. As Harley Davidson fits into the lifestyle of a certain group of people, and Prada shoes fit the lifestyle of another group, it is the lifestyle that came first. Like the products the company produces that serve as proof of the company's why, so too does a brand or product serve as proof of an individual's why. Others, even some who work for Apple, will say that what truly distinguishes them is in fact the quality of their products alone. Having good quality products is of course important. No matter how clear your why, if what you sell doesn't work, the whole thing falls flat. But a company doesn't need to have the best products. They just need to be good or very good. Better or best is a relative comparison anyway. Without first understanding why, the comparison itself is of no value to the decision maker. The concept of better begs the question, based on what standard? Is a Ferrari F430 sports car better than a Honda Odyssey minivan? It depends why you need the car. If you have a family of six, a two-seater Ferrari is not better. However, if you're looking for a great way to meet women, a Honda minivan is probably not better. Depending on what kind of women you're looking to meet, of course. I, too, shouldn't make assumptions. Why the product exists must first be considered, and why someone wants it must match. I could tell you about all the engineering marvels of the Honda Odyssey, some of which may actually be better than a Ferrari. It certainly gets better gas mileage. The odds are I'm not going to convince someone who really wants that sports car to buy anything else. that some people are viscerally drawn to a Ferrari, more than a Honda Odyssey, says more about the person than the engineering of the product. The engineering, for example, would simply be one of the tangible points that a Ferrari lover could point out to prove how he feels about his car. The dogged defense of the superiority of Ferrari engineering to the person whose personality is predisposed to favor all those features and benefits cannot be an objective conversation. Why do you think most people who buy Ferraris are willing to pay a premium simply to get it in red, whereas most people who buy Honda Odysseys don't care much about the color at all? For all those who will try to convince you that Apple computers are just better, I cannot dispute a single claim. All I can offer is that most of the factors that they believe make them better meet their standard of what a computer should be. With that in mind, Macintoshes are, in practice, only better for those who believe what Apple believes. Those people who share Apple's why believe that Apple's products are objectively better, and any attempt to convince them otherwise is pointless. Even with objective metrics in hand, the argument about which is better or which is worse without first establishing a common standard creates nothing more than a debate. Loyalists for each brand will point to various features and benefits that matter to them or don't matter to them in an attempt to convince the other that they are right. And that's one of the primary reasons why so many companies feel the need to differentiate in the first place, based on the flawed assumption that only one group can be right. But what if both parties were right? What if an Apple was right for some people and a PC was right for others? It's not a debate about better or worse anymore. It's a discussion about different needs. And before the discussion can even happen, the whys for each must be established first. A simple claim of better, even with the rational evidence to back it up, can create desire and even motivate a decision to buy. But it doesn't create loyalty. If a customer feels inspired to buy a product rather than manipulated, they will be able to verbalize the reasons why they think what they bought is actually better. Good quality and features matter, but they are not enough to produce the dogged loyalty that all of the most inspiring leaders and companies are all able to command. It is the cause that is represented by the company, the brand, or their products that inspires loyalty. Not the only way, just one way. Knowing your why is not the only way to be successful, but it is the only way to maintain a lasting success and have a greater blend of innovation and flexibility. When a why goes fuzzy, it becomes much more difficult to maintain the growth, loyalty, and inspiration that helped drive the original success. By difficult, I mean that manipulation, rather than inspiration, fast becomes the strategy of choice to motivate behavior. This is effective in the short term, but comes at a high cost in the long term. Consider the classic business school case of the railroads. In the late 1800s, the railroads were the biggest companies in the country. Having achieved such monumental success, even changing the landscape of America, remembering why stopped being important to them. Instead, they became obsessed with what they do. They were in the railroad business. This narrowing of perspective influenced their decision-making. They invested all of their money in tracks and cross ties and engines. But at the beginning of the 20th century, a new technology was introduced, the airplane. And all those big railroad companies eventually went out of business. What if they had defined themselves as being in the mass transportation business? Perhaps their behavior would have been different. Perhaps they would have seen opportunities that they otherwise missed. Perhaps they would own all the airlines today. The comparison raises the question of the long-term survivability of so many other companies that have defined themselves and their industries by what they do. They have been doing it the same way for so long that their ability to compete against a new technology or see a new perspective becomes a daunting task. The story of the railroads has an eerie similarity to the case of the music industry discussed earlier. This is another industry that has not done a good job of adjusting its business model to fit a behavioral change prompted by a new technology. But other industries, whose business models evolved in a different time, show similar cracks. The newspaper, publishing, and television industries, to name but three. These are the current-day railroads that are struggling to define their value while watching their customers turn to companies from other industries to serve their needs. Perhaps if music companies had a clearer sense of why, they would have seen the opportunity to invent the equivalent of iTunes instead of leaving it to a scrappy computer company to do it. In all cases, going back to the original purpose, cause, or belief will help these industries adapt. Instead of asking, what should we do to compete, or how should we compete, the question must be asked, why did we start doing what we're doing in the first place? And what can we do to bring our cause to life, considering all the technologies and market opportunities available today? But don't take my word for it. None of this is my opinion. It is all firmly grounded in the tenets of biology. Chapter 4. This is not opinion. This is biology. Now, the star-belly sneetches had bellies with stars, and the plain-belly sneetches had none upon thars. Those stars weren't so big, they were really so small. You might think such a thing wouldn't matter at all. Then, quickly, Sylvester McMonkey McBean put together a very peculiar machine. And he said, you want stars like a star-belly sneetch? My friends, you can have them for $3 each. In his 1961 story about the sneetches, Dr. Seuss introduced us to two groups of sneetches, one with stars on their bellies and the other with none. The ones without stars on their bellies wanted desperately to have stars so they could feel like they fit in. They were willing to go to extreme lengths and pay larger and larger and larger sums of money simply to feel that they were part of a group. But only Sylvester McMonkey McBean, the man whose machine put stars upon thars, profited from the sneetch's desire to fit in. As with so many things, Dr. Seuss explained it best. The sneetches perfectly captured a very basic human need, the need to belong. Our need to belong is not rational, but it is a constant that exists across all people in all cultures. It is a feeling we get when those around us share our values and beliefs. When we feel like we belong, we feel connected and we feel safe. As humans, we crave the feeling and we seek it out. Sometimes our feeling of belonging is incidental. We're not friends with everyone from our hometown, but travel across the state and you may meet someone from your hometown and you instantly have a connection with them. We're not friends with everyone from our home state, but travel across the country and you feel a special bond with someone you meet who is from your home state. Go abroad and you form an instant bond with other Americans you meet. I remember a trip I took to Australia. One day I was on a bus and I heard an American accent. I turned and struck up a conversation and I immediately felt connected to them. We could speak the same language, understand the same slang. As a stranger in a strange city, for that brief moment, I felt like I belonged. And because of it, I trusted those strangers on the bus more than any other passengers. In fact, we spent time together later. No matter where we go, we trust those with whom we are able to perceive common values or beliefs. Our desire to feel like we belong is so powerful that we will go to great lengths or do irrational things, even spend money to get that feeling. Like the sneetches, we want to be around people and organizations who are like us and share our beliefs. When companies talk about what they do and how advanced their products are, they may have appeal, but they do not necessarily represent something to which we want to belong. But when a company clearly communicates their why, what they believe, and if we believe what they believe, then we will sometimes go to extraordinary lengths to include those products or brands in our lives. This is not because they are better, but because they become markers or symbols of the values and beliefs we hold dear. Those products and brands make us feel like we belong, and we feel a kinship with others who buy the same things as us. Fan clubs started by customers are often formed without any help from the company itself. These people form communities, in person or online, not just to share their love of a product, but to be in the company of people like them. Their decisions have nothing to do with the company or its products. They have everything to do with the individuals themselves. Our natural need to feel like we belong also makes us good at spotting things that don't belong. It's a sense we get, a feeling, something deep inside us, something we can't put into words that allows us to feel how some things just seem to fit and how some things just don't. Dell selling MP3 players just didn't feel right, because Dell defines themselves as a computer company, so the only things that belong are computers. Apple defines itself as a company on a mission, and so anything that they do that fits that definition feels like it belongs. In 2004, they produced a promotional iPod in partnership with the iconoclastic Irish rock band U2. That makes sense. They would never have produced a promotional iPod with Celine Dion, even though she's sold vastly more records than U2 and may have a bigger audience, U2 and Apple belong together because they share the same values and beliefs. They both push boundaries. It would not have made sense if Apple released a special iPod with Celine Dion. As big as her audience may be, the partnership just wouldn't align. Look no farther than Apple's TV commercials. I'm a Mac, and I'm a PC, for a perfect representation of who a Mac user needs to be to feel like they belong. In the commercial, the Mac user is a young guy, always in jeans and a t-shirt, always relaxed and always with a sense of humor, poking fun at the system. The PC, as defined by Apple, is in a suit, older, stodgy. To fit in with Mac, you have to be like Mac. Microsoft responded to Apple with its own I'm a PC campaign, which depicts people from all walks of life identifying themselves as PC. Microsoft included many more people in their ads, teachers, scientists, musicians, and children. As one would expect from the company that supplies 95% of the computer operating systems, to belong to that crowd, you have to be everyone else. One is not better or worse. It depends on where you feel like you belong. Are you a rabble-riser, or are you with the majority? We are drawn to leaders and organizations that are good at communicating what they believe. Their ability to make us feel like we belong, to make us feel special, safe, and not alone, is part of what gives them the ability to inspire us. Those whom we consider great leaders all have an ability to draw us close and to command our loyalty. And we feel a strong bond with those who are also drawn to the same leaders and organizations. Apple users feel a bond with each other. Harley riders are bonded to each other also. Anyone who is drawn to hear Dr. Martin Luther King give his famous I Have a Dream speech, regardless of their race, religion, or sex, stood together in the crowd as brothers and sisters, bonded by their shared values and beliefs. They knew they belonged together because they could feel it in their gut. Gut decisions don't happen in your stomach. The principles of the Golden Circle are much more than a communications hierarchy. Its principles are deeply grounded in the evolution of human behavior. The power of why is not just opinion, it's biology. If you look at a cross-section of the human brain from the top down, you see that the levels of the Golden Circle correspond precisely with the three major levels of the brain. The newest area of the brain, our Homo sapien brain, is the neocortex, which corresponds with the what level. The neocortex is responsible for rational and analytical thought and language. The middle two sections, how and why, comprise the limbic brain. The limbic brain is responsible for all of our feelings, such as trust and loyalty. It is also responsible for all human behavior and all our decision-making, but it has no capacity for language. When we communicate from the outside in, when we communicate what we do first, yes, people can understand vast amounts of complicated information, like facts and figures, but it does not drive behavior. But when we communicate from the inside out, when we start with why, we're talking directly to the part of the brain that controls decision-making, and our language part of the brain allows us to rationalize those decisions. The part of the brain that controls our feelings has no capacity for language. This is the disconnection that makes putting our feelings into words so hard. We have trouble, for example, explaining why we married the person we married. We struggle to put into words the real reasons why we love them, so we talk around it or rationalize it. She's funny. She's smart, we say. But there are lots of funny and smart people in the world, but we don't love them, and we don't want to marry them. There is obviously more to falling in love than just personality and competence. Rationally, we know our explanation isn't the real reason. It is how our loved ones make us feel. But those feelings are really hard to put into words. So when pushed, we start to talk around it. We may even say things that don't make any rational sense. She completes me, we might say, for example. What does that mean? How do you look for someone who does that so you can marry them? That's the problem with love. We only know we found it because it just feels right. The same is true for other decisions. When a decision feels right, we have a hard time explaining why we did what we did. Again, the part of the brain that controls decision-making doesn't control language, so we rationalize. This complicates the value of polls and market research. Asking people why they chose you over another may provide wonderful evidence of how they've rationalized the decision, but it does not shed much light on the true motivation for the decision. It's not that people don't know, it's that they have trouble explaining why they do what they do. Decision-making and the ability to explain those decisions exist in different parts of the brain. This is where gut decisions come from. They just feel right. There is no part of the stomach that controls decision-making. It all happens in the limbic brain. And it's not an accident that we use the verb to feel to explain those decisions either. The reason gut decisions feel right is because the part of the brain that controls them also controls our feelings. Whether you defer to your gut or you're simply following your heart, no matter which part of the body you think is driving the decision, the reality is it's all in your limbic brain. Our limbic brain is powerful. Powerful enough to drive behavior that sometimes contradicts our rational and analytical understanding of a situation. We often trust our gut, even if the decision flies in the face of all the facts and figures. Richard Restack, a well-known neuroscientist, talks about this in his book, The Naked Brain. When you force people to make decisions with only the rational part of their brain, they almost invariably end up, quote-unquote, overthinking. These rational decisions tend to take longer to make, says Restack, and can often be of lower quality. In contrast, decisions made with the limbic brain, gut decisions, tend to be faster and higher quality decisions. This is one of the primary reasons why teachers tell students to go with their first instinct when taking a multiple choice test, to trust their gut. The more time spent thinking about the answer, the bigger the risk that it may be the wrong one. Our limbic brains are smart and often know the right thing to do. It is our inability to verbalize those reasons that may cause us to doubt ourselves or trust the empirical evidence when our gut tells us not to. Consider the experience of buying a flat-screen TV at your local electronics store. You stand in the aisle listening to an expert explain to you the difference between LCD and plasma. The sales rep gives you all the rational differences and benefits, yet you're still none the wiser as to which one is right for you. After an hour or two, you still have no clue. Your mind is on overload because you're overthinking the decision. You eventually make a choice and walk out of the store, still not 100% convinced you chose the right one. Then you go to your friend's house and see that he bought the other one. He goes on and on about how much he loves his TV. Suddenly you're jealous. Even though you still don't know that his is any better than yours, you wonder, did I buy the wrong one? Companies that fail to communicate a sense of why force us to make decisions with only empirical evidence. This is why those decisions take more time, feel difficult, or leave us uncertain. Under these conditions, manipulative strategies that exploit our desires, fears, doubts, or fantasies work very well. We're forced to make these less than inspiring decisions for one simple reason. Companies don't offer us anything else besides the facts and figures and features and benefits upon which to base our decisions. Companies don't tell us why. People don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. A failure to communicate why creates nothing but stress or doubt. In contrast, many people who are drawn to buy Macintosh computers or Harley-Davidson motorcycles, for example, don't need to talk to anyone about which brand to choose. They feel the utmost confidence in their decision, and the only question they ask is which Mac or which Harley. At that level, the rational features and benefits, the facts and figures absolutely matter, but not to drive the decision to give money or loyalty to the company or the brand. That decision is already made. The tangible features are simply to help direct the choice of product that best fits our needs. In these cases, the decisions happened in the perfect inside-out order. Those decisions started with why, the emotional component of the decision, and then the rational components allowed the buyer to verbalize or rationalize the reason for their decision and find the product that best suits their needs. This is what we mean when we talk about winning hearts and minds. The heart represents the limbic, feeling part of the brain, and the mind is the rational, language center. Most companies are quite adept at winning minds. All that requires is a comparison of all the features and benefits. Winning hearts, however, takes more work. Given the evidence of the natural order of decision-making, I can't help but wonder if the order of the expression, hearts and minds, is a coincidence. Why does no one set out to win minds and hearts? The ability to win hearts before minds is not easy. It's a delicate balance of art and science, another coincidental grammatical construction. Why is it that things are not a balance of science and art, but always art before science? Perhaps it is a subtle clue our language-impaired limbic brain is sending to us to help us see that the art of leading is about following your heart. Perhaps our brains are trying to tell us that why must come first. Absent a why, a decision is harder to make. And when in doubt, we look to science, to data, to guide our decisions. Companies will tell you that the reason they start with what they do or how they do it is because that's what their customers ask for. Quality, service, price, features. That's what the data reported, they'll say. But for the fact that the part of the brain that controls decision-making is different from the part of the brain that is able to report back that decision, it would be a perfectly valid conclusion to give people what they ask for. Unfortunately, there is more evidence that sales don't significantly increase and the bonds of loyalty are not formed simply when companies say or do everything their customers want. Henry Ford summed it up best. He said, "If I had asked people what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse." This is the genius of great leadership. Great leaders in great organizations are good at seeing what most of us can't see. They are good at giving us the things we would never think of asking for. When the computer revolution was in full swing, computer users couldn't ask for a graphical user interface, but that's what Apple gave us. In the face of expanding competition in the airline industry, most air travelers would never have thought to ask for less instead of more, but that's what Southwest did. And in the face of hard times and overwhelming odds, few would have asked their country, "What can I do for you?" over "What you can do for me," the very cause upon which John F. Kennedy introduced his presidency. Great leaders are those who trust their gut. They are those who understand the art before the science. They win hearts before minds. They are the ones who start with why. We make decisions all day, and many of them are emotionally driven. Rarely do we sift through all the available information to ensure we know every fact, and we don't need to. It's all about degrees of certainty. "I can make a decision with 30% of the information," said former Secretary of State Colin Powell. "Anything more than 80% is too much." There is always a level at which we trust ourselves or those around us to guide us, and don't always feel we need all the facts and figures. And sometimes, we just may not trust ourselves to make a certain decision yet. This may explain why we feel, there's that word again, so uncomfortable when others twist our arm to make a decision that doesn't sit well in our gut. We trust our gut to help us decide whom to vote for or which shampoo to buy. Because our biology complicates our ability to verbalize the real reasons why we make these decisions, we rationalize based on more tangible factors, like the design or the service or the brand. This is the basis for the false assumption that price or features matter more than they do. Those things matter. They provide us the tangible things we can point to rationalize our decision-making. But they do not set the course, and they do not inspire behavior. It's what you can't see that matters. "Get your whites whiter and your brights brighter," said the TV commercial for the newest laundry detergent. This was the value proposition for so many years in the laundry detergent business. A perfectly legitimate claim. That's what the market research revealed. That's what customers wanted. Although the data was true, the truth of what people wanted was different. The makers of laundry detergent asked consumers what they wanted, and consumers said whiter whites and brighter brights. Not such a remarkable finding if you think about it, that people doing laundry wanted their detergent to help get their clothes not just clean, but very clean. So brands attempted to differentiate how they got your whites whiter and your brights brighter, by trying to convince consumers that one additive was more effective than another. "Protein," said one. "Color enhancers," said another. No one asked consumers why they wanted their clothes clean. That little nugget wasn't revealed until many years later, when a group of anthropologists hired by one of the packaged good companies revealed that all those additives weren't in fact driving behavior. They observed that when people took their washing out of the dryer, no one held it up in the light to see how white it was, or compared it to newer items to see how bright it was. The first thing people did when they pulled their laundry out of the dryer was to smell it. This was an amazing discovery. Feeling clean was more important to people than being clean. There was a presumption that all detergents get your clothes clean. That's what detergent is supposed to do. but having their clothes smell fresh and clean mattered much more than the nuanced differences between which detergent actually made clothes measurably cleaner. That a false assumption swayed an entire industry to follow the wrong direction is not unique to detergents. Cell phone companies believed people wanted more options and buttons, until Apple introduced its iPhone with fewer options and only one button. The German automakers believed that their engineering alone mattered to American car buyers. They were stunned and perplexed when they learned that great engineering wasn't enough. One by one, the German luxury car makers begrudgingly added cup holders to their fine automobiles. It was a feature that mattered a great deal to the commuter-minded Americans, but was rarely mentioned in any research about what factors influence purchase decisions. I'm not for a moment proposing that cup holders make people loyal to BMWs. All I am proposing is that even for the rationally minded car buyers, there is more to decision-making than meets the eye. Literally. The power of the limbic brain is astounding. It not only controls our gut decisions, but it can influence us to do things that seem illogical or irrational. Leaving the safety of home to explore faraway places, crossing oceans to see what's on the other side, leaving a stable job to start a business out of your basement with no money in the bank? Many of us look at these decisions and say, "That's stupid. You're crazy. You could lose everything. You could get yourself killed. What are you thinking?" It is not logic or facts, but our hopes and dreams, our hearts and our guts that drive us to try new things. If we were all rational, there would be no small businesses, there would be no exploration, there would be very little innovation, and there would be no great leaders to inspire all those things. It is the undying belief in something bigger and better that drives the kind of behavior. But it can also control behavior born out of other emotions, like hate and fear. Why else would someone plot to hurt someone they have never met? The amount of market research that reveals that people want to do business with the company that offers them the best quality products, with the most features, the best service, and all at a good price is astounding. But consider the companies with the greatest loyalty. They rarely have all those things. If you wanted to buy a custom Harley, you used to have to wait 6 months for delivery. To give them credit, they got it down from a year. Hello, that's bad service. Apple computers are at least 25% more expensive than the comparable PC. There is less software available for their operating system. They have fewer peripherals. The machines themselves are sometimes slower than a comparable PC. If people made only rational decisions and did all the research before making a purchase, no one would ever buy a Mac. But of course people do. And some don't even buy them. They love them. A feeling that comes straight from the heart. Or the limbic brain. We all know someone who is a diehard Mac lover. Ask them why they love their Mac. They won't tell you. Well, you see, I see myself as someone who likes to challenge the status quo, and it's important for me to surround myself with the people and the products and the brands that prove to the outside world who I believe I am. Biologically, that's what happened. But the decision was made in the part of the brain that controls behavior, but not language. So they will provide a rationalization. It's the user interface, they'll say. It's the simplicity. It's the design. It's the high quality. They are the best computers. I am a creative person. In reality, their purchase decision and their loyalty are deeply personal. They don't really care about Apple. It's all about them. The same can even be said for the people who love to work at Apple. Even employees can't put it into words. In their case, their job is one of the what's to their why. They too are convinced that it's the quality of the products alone that is behind Apple's success. But deep inside, they all love being a part of something bigger than themselves. The most loyal Apple employees, like the most loyal Apple customers, all love a good revolution. A great raise and added benefits couldn't convince any loyal Apple employee to work for Dell. And no amount of cashback incentives and rebates could convince a loyal Mac user to switch to a PC. Many are already paying double the price. This is beyond rational. This is a belief. It's no accident that the culture at Apple is often described as a cult. It's more than just products. It's a cause to support. It's a matter of faith. Remember the comparison of the Honda and the Ferrari? Products are not just symbols of what the company believes. They also serve as symbols of what the loyal buyers believe. People with Apple laptop computers, for example, love opening them up while sitting in an airport. They like that everyone knows that they're using a Mac. It's an emblem, a symbol of who they are. That glowing Apple logo speaks to something about them, about how they see the world. Does anyone notice when someone pops open the lid of a computer that says HP or Dell on it? No, not even the people using the computers care. HP and Dell have a fuzzy sense of why, so their products and their brands don't symbolize anything about the users. To the Dell or HP user, their computer, no matter how fast or sleek, is not a symbol of a higher purpose, cause, or belief. It's just a computer. In fact, for the longest time, the logo on the Dell